Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. July 24, 2020. My thoughts on Twitter July 24, 2020. People don't realize the need for a kind mutual closeness that the coronavirus is pushing us to. But we have to speak of it and study the sources of our teachers, the Kubber lists. This will prepare society and elevate us. All of us are repelled by the need for a kind mutual understanding and closeness, but otherwise nature will force us into it through suffering. Kabbalah students are obliged to explain to everyone that our future depends on embracing our closeness. Otherwise, the transition to it will be bloody. The future is near. If we really are undergoing a transition to a new society, from egoistic to altruistic, this transition is incumbent upon the nation of Israel. And if we don't take this upon ourselves, then nature will force us, as usual, with harsh pressure. We will be worse off than anyone in order to provide an example of closeness. According to Kabbalah, if we are really undergoing a transition to a new generation, from egoism to altruism, then the only sure remedy against the pandemic is a good closeness between people, and especially between Israelis. This is what society and the government must focus on. From Twitter, July 24, 2020. My new article on LinkedIn: how exactly COVID-19 changes us. I see how from one day to the next, the world is becoming more accepting and accustomed to its new conditions. Of course, there is a lot of reluctance and tension at the boundary of this acceptance. Human nature, the so-called evil inclination that prioritizes self-benefit at the expense of others, received a few major blows, and it is still swinging back with all of its might. We try to hold on to our culture that glorifies wealth, fame and power, where we pit ourselves against each other and have no choice but to compete with each other to reach the top of our respective individual empires. But nature's evolutionary steamroller continually flattens out this evil inclination's throes of death. It infected humanity with the virus in order to awaken upon us a new sensation of a much greater interdependent reality, outside of our self-serving worldviews. We have already undergone a major transition from resisting our new restrictive conditions, which we were forced into, to gradually coming to terms with them. If we knew for a fact that this pandemic has saved us from a much greater hatred-infused blow that we would have inflicted upon ourselves, like a war, then we would be happy for our current state. I understand that the virus has killed and infected vast amounts of people, and that many more have become financially and personally stressed. But if we could see the overarching global tendency taking place, then we would see that this current direction has spared us more suffering than if we had continued our previous ways. For instance, I view it favorably that authorities are preoccupied with the health, well-being, and future of their own publics instead of complicating themselves on international scales. Likewise, people across the board fare better by being more essentials focused instead of letting themselves get confused with the smorgasbord of surplus luxuries, which repeatedly fail to provide any lasting satisfaction. Nature has given us something to be busy with, through which we can change our ways and start perceiving our surrounding reality afresh. Also, today's speed of change is unprecedented. Therefore, I very much hope that in the coming months, we will witness a more understanding and empathetic humanity, one more perceptive of the process it is undergoing, and a humanity that knows how to progress more smoothly to a well-connected, safe, healthy and happy future. My new article on Bizcatalist making sense of the global anarchy. When you look at the world these days, all you see is anarchy. America is embroiled in an election campaign that's so thick with hatred that one can only hope it will not end in a civil war. The EU has just signed a gigantic post-COVID recovery package, but the squabbling leading to the agreement exposed the aversion the member nations in the bloc feel for one another. Besides, we're nowhere near a post-COVID reality. The package relies on an economic recovery that will not happen, and taxes on revenues that will not come, making the implementation of the package more than unlikely. Meanwhile, the Middle East has never been a role model of stability, but today even more so, there's not a single country in this war-stricken region that's not disintegrating from within or whose economy is shattered and the citizens go hungry or both. Add to it the nearly signed China and Iran trade and military partnership, the tension between the US and North Korea over the latter's nuclear program, the deteriorating relationship between Moscow and Washington, and you end up finding Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov's succinct statement very fitting: the situation is very bad. In fact, the situation is so bad that when COVID-19 first erupted, it imposed a global paralysis that stalled the deterioration of the world toward a world war. But recently, the global outbursts of anarchy are proving that hatred spreads faster than even the coronavirus. I am not pessimistic. When you look at the current chaos from the point of view of the end of the process, where all become one, it is clear that the only reason for the growing anarchy is to impel us to choose unity over dissension and antagonism. Moreover, because at the moment we are clearly choosing to fight one another for having different views than ours, anarchy is the only way to convince us that hatred doesn't pay. As long as we are not convinced, anarchy will have to keep growing and inflict more torments on humanity. When chaos takes over and we have nothing to eat and no one to trust, we will be convinced to change course. But wouldn't it be wiser to choose unity before all this happens? When unity finally prevails, it will not include agreement among everyone. People were born different and will remain different for a good reason. Their differing views are expressions of the differences between them, which must remain. The problem is not that we are different, it is that we hate other people for not thinking like us, looking like us, speaking like us, and behaving like us, namely for not being us. The problem is our sense of entitlement and the conviction that only I am right, and everybody else is wrong. But if I hate people for thinking differently, even if they're wrong, can it be that I am right? Can one nurture hatred and yet be right? Hatred is the denial of another person's right to a different opinion, character, race, faith, or anything that is not me. If I hate it, it means that I think it shouldn't exist. In simple words, hatred is the denial of another person's right to exist. Nothing right can come out of that perspective. Contrary to our self-centered perspective, the world is one inclusive whole. Its elements complement one another so completely that no part can exist without its opposite. We can achieve unity only when we keep those opposites in balanced equilibrium. Night and day, summer and winter, birth and death, all those opposites don't create anarchy. On the contrary, they create order, maintain balance, and sustain life. In order to tap into that perspective, we must aim for the final outcome, the unity of all of humanity. When you place the unity of humanity at the end of the process and examine past and current events with union in mind, you realize that human development is moving inexorably in that direction. It is not a bad outcome. It is not a future of shortage or stress. It is a future of calm, prosperity, and mutual care for everyone. But because our egos resist caring for others, it depicts that future is grim and forbidding. But calm and prosperity cannot be grim or forbidding. We can choose to approach our promising future quickly and pleasantly, working hand in hand on creating a thriving, diverse society whose members care for one another, or we can spurn the inevitable, insist on separation and hatred, and wait for reality to drag us to happiness against our will. My new article on San Diego Jewish World: Lack of Jewish Unity Spurs Antisemitism. The longer the pandemic lingers, the more the world will turn a blaming eye toward us, the Jews. Anytime affliction grows around the world, it directs its anger at the Jews. A few days ago, far-right white nationalist Canadian politician Travis Patron released a video stating, "What we need to do, perhaps more than anything, is remove these people, once and for all, from our country." He's not alone, and these ideas do not come only from the far right. There is ample evidence of anti-Semitism on the left, as well, and even people who aren't known for their extreme views express or share anti-Semitic social media posts. Just like the Jews in Germany before World War II tried to convince the Nazis that they were good Germans but to no avail, Jews today are trying to convince the world that we are good people. They say that Jews donate to charity more than any other nation or faith, that they contribute to high-tech innovations that advance the world far above their proportion in the world, that Jews have given the world many great physicians, thinkers, artists, and entrepreneurs, and that they are ardent human rights activists. But the world largely responds with contempt. It may be ironic, but it seems very natural for anti-racism protesters to yell "dirty Jews" at counter-protesters, as the Jerusalem Post reported on June 15. In other words, many people don't even relate to anti-Semitism as a type of racism. Jew hatred is irrational. It doesn't need justification, though one is always found, and it always grows when times are hard. But there is a very good explanation for it, though most Jews and most non-Jews are unaware of it. The first Hebrew, Abraham, left his hometown, Haran, in ancient Babylon, when his country folk rejected him. Midrash Rabbah, Maimonides, and many other sources describe Abraham's findings, that his people had become alienated from each other. He tried to bring them together, to help them rise above their egocentric attitude to one another. But instead of gratitude, he suffered their disdain. Eventually, they excommunicated him and drove him out of Babylon. But Abraham succeeded. As he wandered west toward Canaan, more and more people joined him since they felt that unity above hatred is the right way to live, while those they had left behind wallowed in their hatred and eventually disintegrated. At the same time, Abraham's people became a nation and continued to work on their unity, despite the many conflicts that arose within them. That ancient schism between Abraham's group with its method of unity, and the rest of the Babylonians with their mindset of individuality, is the hidden root of all forms of Jew hatred. And since the Babylonian culture had spread across the globe, there is not a single place on earth without latent antisemitism waiting for a crisis to trigger it. And if the ancient rupture isn't enough to justify antisemitism, upon their exodus from Egypt, the Jews not only achieved complete unity, although it soon faded, but were also tasked with being a light unto nations to spread that unity to the rest of the world. For nearly 2 millennia, the Jews had fought to keep their unity and be faithful to their mission. But some 2,000 years ago, they succumbed to their egoism, which they called unfounded hatred, and were dispersed. Since then, they have become unfit to carry out their mission as a chosen people since their hatred for each other prevents them from spreading unity. Because the Jews fell from brotherly love, from the motto "love your neighbor as yourself," into unfounded hatred, the world does not view them as the carriers of unity. But even so, it still regards them as responsible for the world's troubles, and especially the wars. Ask any anti-Semite who is responsible for all the wars in the world, and they will tell you it's the Jews. Although they are unaware of it, by holding the Jews responsible for all the troubles in the world, anti-Semites are saying indirectly that the Jews aren't bringing peace. Inadvertently, they are admitting that the task the Jews were given at the foot of Mount Sinai is still valid, and that not carrying it out is the reason for their hatred. What then should the Jews do about it? Exactly what the anti-Semites, subconsciously, expect them to do: unite and project that unity to the world, be a light unto nations. Since the Jewish people are descendants of Babylonians from tribes and clans that were often sworn enemies until they joined Abraham's group, if the Jews unite above their hatred, it will set an example and pave the way for the rest of the nations. Ironically, The only cure for anti-Semitism is Jewish unity, and sharing it with the world. It turns out that the greatest danger to the Jewish people is not knowing their task. Spiritual war for peace. Only women, united, can change the situation in the world and restore order in it. But, unfortunately, women do not actively express themselves. Every country has laws that allow women to demand access to leadership in order to properly organize life in the country. Usually women are fighting for their own rights, for equality, and this is like a family showdown in the kitchen. But I am talking about spiritual warfare. A woman must understand that this is the most important thing right now, and she needs to oblige the whole world like a mother makes her children study, clean up after themselves, go to school, and Washington. That is how the role of women needs to be seen, as the mother of mankind. The whole world expects women to start performing their role correctly and oblige everyone to realize and understand the spiritual goal of the world. When we connect with one another correctly, we allow the upper light, the higher force of nature, to enter into us, and begin to work on us. This is the role of a woman, the role of a mother. It turns out that the fight should not be for the rights of women themselves, but for their ability to influence society. Women lack knowledge, connection, and organization. If they want to move forward, they will have to learn a lot and, in accordance with this, properly unite, learn about their mission, and with the appropriate wisdom and feelings, realize their purpose. There is no other way out, just like with a child who does not want to learn. It is not easy for a woman to do this because throughout history she has been used to staying in the shadows. Only the right education will help. They need to start with small roles, and from that a serious organization will develop. A woman must know the program and purpose of creation, the stages through which we move, and how they are achieved. And besides, women who begin to study today are preparing themselves to become leaders of society and humanity. You must be aware that you are fulfilling a special mission and must be more persistent every day and ready to do anything to save humanity from the difficult trials that await us, if we do not correctly implement this special stage. I am sure that you are able to do this, and I am ready to help in any way I can. I wish you success. From CAB TV's Women in the New World, June 30th, 2020. Have the right thoughts. Question: we know that not all people have a sense of awareness. How can they rebuild that? Answer: they can. What is man? Every minute he has 1,000 different thoughts, among which more correct ones will arise. It all depends only on what kind of environment he falls into. Therefore, it is necessary to organize the correct environment around us. Then the right thoughts will arise and we will quickly go forward. From CAB TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, May 10th, 2020. You were right. Question: in 2001, the year when the Twin Towers were destroyed in America on September 11th, you said that this is the first sign that showed the weakness of this system. I didn't really want to believe it, but over the past 20 years, life shows that you were right. What was the basis of your saying this? Answer: only on the fact that in nature everything is arranged in such a way that it comes to its beginning, prosperity, and end. Therefore, I saw in these towers, and indeed in everything that happened and is happening in America, a sequential process leading to the need to change the system based on absolute egoism. And here you will not get anywhere. We may not even catch a complete change of this formation, but it will happen. There can be nothing else in nature. Our world is integral, global, closed in the form of a ball. Through our solidarity and consciousness, we must bring it to a state where we are correctly connected with each other and with the surrounding nature. We have nowhere to go from this. From CAB TV's Today's International Situation, June 18th, 2020. individuality and interconnection. Question: biologists have found that many living organisms can make collective decisions. For example, in some bacterial environments, uniformity is achieved by the release of a specific chemical. It may be a sign of danger that they are communicating to each other in this way. A school of fish recognizes a predator faster and more precisely than individual fish. While separate people, even the most intelligent with a high IQ, still cannot solve the problems that a team solves. That is, there are clear manifestations of the collective mind. But there is a paradox here. On the one hand, nature develops our individuality throughout history. On the other hand, we observe that it is not the strongest who survives, but the one who is more adapted to cooperate. How can this paradox be resolved? Answer: individuality should not be contrary to integrality, reciprocity, or the right connection with each other. There are separate elements in any system. Each of them is very important and perfect in its own way. But the interaction between them must be calibrated so that in their feelings, influence, and combinations with each other, they feel that they are guided by their common interconnection. Therefore, one does not contradict the other. On one hand, we would like to gather a team that would consist of genius and extraordinary people. On the other hand, there must be absolute interaction, connection, and integration between them. Otherwise, what good are these individuals? Question: so natural selection and evolution seem to exist together? Answer: the fact is that evolution is given to us by nature. But along with evolution, or perhaps in some ways contrary to it, nature requires us to unite and become more interconnected with each generation. We have not done this for many generations, and therefore, we suffer greatly. From CAB TV's post-coronavirus era, April 30, 2020. To feel the plus, you have to feel the minus. Question: if everything becomes absolutely magnificent, how does a person move to where or what can someone develop? It would be boring. Answer: I understand that when everything is beautiful, clean, and good, it is very boring. There is no dirt, swearing, nothing like this is felt, no nobility stands out against the background of something nasty. But don't worry. I can't explain it now, but you will always have a possibility to build good above evil. And when evil exhausts itself, everything will be filled with such good, infinity and eternity will be revealed to you. When we study this, you will feel it. You are right about one thing: to be able to feel plus, you have to feel minus. These two states must necessarily support each other in their mutual realization. From CAB TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, May 10, 2020. New Life 1175. The Awareness of Death.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the New Life Show with Dr. Michael Lightman. Hello, Dr. Lightman. Hello. Hello, Yael. Hello. And today we'd like to talk about being aware of death. Death as a part of our life. And we'd like to understand what death is a bit more deeply. Be with us, Yael, please. We all know that the day will come when we'll die, and along with it, there's this feeling that we're not really aware of death throughout life. We celebrate life. Maybe were we really aware of death seriously, then we wouldn't go outside because you have roads, dangers, evil people. And still here, we're living our life, celebrating it. And on this show, we'd like to see to what extent are we aware of the fact that the day will come when we'll die, and how does that affect our life, and how can we really deal with the awareness of death? Should we be aware of our death or not? And to hear from you, from a person that sees life more broadly than people usually do, and I'd like to ask, When does a person remember that the day will come where he will have to leave this life? And what happens from that point on? Dr. Lightman, what happens? We can ask people. I just want to say that I don't want to come out of this show breaking different concessions and so on. But the way a person thinks about life and death, this is how he lives his life, sometimes more, sometimes less, but a person always lives out of his own desire. What's good for him? This is something that he'll engage and delve in, try to keep that thought more and expand it. What doesn't give him as much pleasure or even makes him suffer, then he wants to move away from it and not feel it and to hide himself from it. It's like a little child that shuts his eyes this way and that's it. He doesn't see anything. For him, it's a sign that there is nothing. Everything's gone. And this is how we really are all throughout life. And therefore, the matter of death depends on the measure to which I'm aware of it. The measure to which I think about it, that I can change it. Different calculations. And the desire to receive that accompanies me all the time actually arranges me correctly, meaning to the measure to which I can live my life and feel the best I can. I always choose. I'm a machine that always chooses maximum pleasure with minimum effort. This is actually my entire work. And even if I make efforts, then it's in order to receive some kind of pleasure in the future. But I'll never think about death unless it really has some kind of reason, justification. And about life, I do. Yeah, what could be justification to think about death, Dr. Lightman? God forbid you get ill or there's some kind of danger. So all in all, I think about this possibility. However, even in a state where a person is already really old, or people that they're already told that they don't have much time left to live, still they're not that aware that that's how it is. And also the matter of the soul and the next world. I saw people that we're told that tomorrow you're going to die from one day to the next. And they were even told the precise hour. I met such a person in the hospital. And around him were his relatives. And he talked about it actually in a good way, nicely. I met religious people that read a confession, and it made them feel good that he's preparing himself for it and what comes afterwards. And I also saw people that don't believe in that and that even don't want to think about some kind of continuity. And therefore, the attitude toward death, let's say that subconsciously, it's always with us. And we maybe once have to arrange these things. But how to arrange this if a person doesn't know what that is? Also, the occurrence itself. It's not the biological death. It's the awareness, understanding, and feeling that everything comes to an end and what remains is some kind of a protein body that ceases to exist. So the biological activity, biochemical activity stops. That's my life. Meaning I'm all in all a sack with different acids and electric signals. Yeah, You said that our attitude toward death always exists in our subconscious. Is a baby born with this feeling that a day will come and so on? Dr. Lightman, at younger ages, at the ages of 5, 6, 7, even before that, children have this kind of feeling of godliness. They even pray regardless of whether it's something customary in their family or not. They have this feeling of death and life, which is completely different than adults do. An adult is already engaged in his life, occupied with it, in some kind of system, with his work and everything, and family and problems. And he forgets about everything already. He doesn't live life, but he kind of survives the day until the days eventually finish him off. But children, they're sensitive toward that until a certain age. Afterwards, the hormones kick in and different things, and then they forget about it. The main thing for them is to fulfill the will to receive. That's awakening in them. And this is how a person disconnects from the matter. And from time to time, again, it catches him in different moments where he's not even aware why, how, that he starts thinking about death. And the main thing is at more advanced ages, at old age. But also at old age, there's a kind of protective system that acts in us, that mitigates these things, that as long as you're alive, feel good today, don't think about tomorrow. And thank God we're not suffering so much in our day-to-day life, even at old age, as we're advancing toward death. It's not necessarily that this thought all the time really pricks our mind. Yael, what is a child's attitude, or how is it different, his awareness towards death, how is it different than that of an adult? Dr. Lightman, a child is much more sensitive. He's much more moved by it. It affects him in such a way that, on the one hand, he'd like to erase these things, like little children that close their eyes. There's nothing. I don't want to see. There's nothing there. On the other hand, it moves him much more than it does, than it moves adults. And so it affects them. But afterwards, it's erased. Let's say that it calms down. And also there's the matter of habit, which becomes a second nature. I remember that when I was in the university, they took us to places like the coroner's office, where you have bodies of people that died in accidents and so on. And I saw that people there relate to it in a very simple way, that this is how it is. And afterwards, I also saw this among religious people, the way they relate to all of these things in a very superficial way. When a person lives, he lives. When he dies, he dies. It really depends on the measure of a person's faith. You know, simple, common faith. And therefore, being aware of death differs from age to age, from culture to culture, depending on the person himself. But one way or another, none of us want to think about it. We all want to postpone the matter, and this is how our nature is, that the good and pleasant things, we want to draw them closer, and the bad things, we want to push them away up to the point of really making them vanish. Owen, I want to ask about nature. In nature, in the system of nature, is there such a concept like being aware of death? Suppose animals, plants, Are they aware of death? Dr. Leitman, yes, but it depends on how they grasp this. The vegetative, of course, they're aware of it because it lives and tomorrow it dies. Whether it's because of the sun or because there's not enough water and so on, or the air, or someone chops it down. Meaning there is such an awareness, but depending on what level. That's on the vegetative level. On the animate level, it's even more. On the animate level, they're all in a struggle. Who's going to eat who? Because just like we eat the still, the vegetative and the animate, the still is water, salt, and so on, and the vegetative, that's clear, vegetables, fruits, and the animate, meaning all the animals, and their meat, fish. The same way any living body in nature lives off the still, the vegetative, and the animate, and so they have struggles over it. And here too, it's not like we use the still, the vegetative, and the animate for them. It's something quite direct that they come and kill. And they struggle for their life, just like we struggle for ours. Owen, so what's unique about a person's awareness of death that animals or plants don't have? Dr. Leitman, an ordinary person. Owen, yeah, did the awareness that nature gives to a person, how is it different than the awareness that animals and plants have? Dr. Leitman, exactly that. Owen, what, maybe there is no difference? Dr. Leitman, there's a difference, of course. The still, the vegetative, and the animate, and of course, especially the animate, they have a feeling that they're leaving life. And the struggle over it, we see the way they're all the time in a struggle between them, in a struggle over life and death. And people, I'd say that they have an addition to that, or a kind of a blur over it, that a person knows what is he dying for, or he doesn't know, but he sees and feels that it's necessary, and he takes it into account, and as if leaves himself, stays in those around him, or with his contemporaries or his offspring that carry on, and then he feels the continuity of his life in that. It's a bit different than the animal, the animate level, because an animal, after a year or two, it disconnects from its offsprings and lives alone again. They live with their offsprings for a year or two, it depends on who we're talking about, but there are even those that live with their offsprings for 3 and 4 years, but eventually they disconnect from them, whereas we don't. Man, he as if leaves himself for the next generation. Owen, why did nature give man a special attitude, a special awareness toward death that other animals don't have? Dr. Leitman, it has to do with a person's development, but it doesn't have anything to do with spiritual development, but with the development of the corporeal consciousness. That we know that this is life, and it has an end, and this is one of our advantages, actually, that allows us to think about the meaning of life. What are we doing with our life? What is it for? Why? What will I have from life? Yeah, it sounds like a person, he has a more long-term calculation, not only about his own life, but also about the next generations, that he as if leaves something for eternity even. Dr. Leitman, sure. He doesn't have this 100% thought that he's going to die, even till the last moment where he's told that now you're going to die, or even that you're being hung or executed. A person doesn't think that he dies. We don't really have the feeling of death. Owen, why? Dr. Leighton, because we are the offsprings, so to speak, offsprings of the upper eternal force, and therefore we can't imagine death as something that ends everything. Yeah, so there's this component in us, Dr. Leighton, from the upper force that does not give us the ability to think about a complete end, that I disappear, that I'm totally eradicated. Yeah, and vegetative and animals, they fight for life, but not on the same level. Okay, fear of death. Some say that it's the biggest fear that a person has. Do you think that's true, correct? Dr. Leighton, yes or no? Because still, we're in a state, we're in such states, that, as it says, it's better to die than live this way. What does that mean? How could that be? But I feel such torments in my life. Everything's measured according to pleasure and pain, that I feel that by getting rid of the suffering that I have in life, that it is more pleasant, better, that I'll benefit more from it than the suffering that I feel in life. And then a person goes to die. Or the other way around, he truly appreciates death, that by that he can promote certain ideas. Yeah. So does it mean that a person really has to suffer in life in order to want that? Or he has to really see value in, Dr. Leighton, always what's worthwhile?
Okay.
As it says, it's good to die for a country, for example, because if by my death I can buy something really special that in my eyes is worth much more than my own life. And here we're not talking about a person thinking that his soul continues after his corporeal body dies, or that he'll be remembered or something. It's a person's pride that this way he elevates himself to the level where death is something desirable. Yeah, there are many suicide bombers and so on that they believe that something's waiting for them. Dr. Leighton, here it's something else. There they promise them the next world, that immediately he enters the Garden of Eden. Yeah, but he believes in it, that for him this is greater than his life here, Dr. Leighton. But all in all, it's psychological work. Yeah, about the fear of death, what's so frightening about death? We see from the very start that death is a part of things, Dr. Leighton, that there's no way back. In our life, everything's a cycle, and here there's no cycle. Were we to see it, the entire matter of death wouldn't mean anything then. What is death then? Were we to feel the incarnations that we go through, then it wouldn't have been called death. Yeah. What frightens a person so much that someday will come when everything will end? Dr. Leighton, it's not that it frightens as much as a person's an egoist and he wants to hold everything in his hands, and that he will not be in control the next moment, but that he completely doesn't know what's going on with him. This is actually the problem. We have such moments in life where we say it would have been good to die now and let go of everything. Owen, so the fear of death is fear of complete loss of control? Dr. Leighton, yeah. Everything is being taken away from him. That's it. You don't exist. Our entire feeling of life is feeling that we're in control of our destiny. And here it's taken away. Sorry. Your fate can be taken away in such a way that from one moment to the next you won't know what's going to happen to you, and in those moments you'll see that it's preferable to die. Yeah, it also explains the matter that people see their death sometimes as a personal failure. What you said now is a very good explanation. A question about the period that we live in. Today, we have less contact with death. In the past, there was more death around people. Even as a mother, many years ago, suppose, I knew as a mother that some of my children won't make it. There were no hospitals or nursing homes, but really, death was present everywhere. Today there's a kind of feeling that death is kind of distant from us. People die in hospitals and nursing homes. If you're a doctor or something, or a police officer, then yes, you will stumble upon this. But a normal person is kind of distanced from that experience. Do you think that that affects the way we perceive life, death? Dr. Lakin, of course. It's all artificial. A person comes to a cemetery, sees some stone, so it's a stone. We have no contact with the dead body. It's something that's beyond life. We don't feel it. Even if someone's ill, then people are ill in hospitals. It's not at home, it's not at work, it's not on the street. It's something that's far from the modern world. We even see in Eastern countries, suppose, in India, Pakistan, there people live on the street, they're ill on the street, they die on the street. Whereas here, in the modern world, everything's sterile. Oh, and what did that do to us compared to previous generations? Dr. Lightman, that we don't think about it. We're not aware of it. We don't have to give account to ourselves. We don't have to give ourselves an answer about my life, about life and death. Oh, and did it make us weaker? Dr. Lightman, on the one hand. On the other hand, freer of it. Today, I take some drugs, some pill, and I'm no longer ill, I'm happy. In the past, people lived next to ill people. There were bodies on the streets, whatnot. Today, I don't have something like that. Suffering was before the eyes of everyone. Today, where do you see suffering? In a newspaper that someone invents something. You don't see it. We've made such a life for ourselves that everything's pink. We're inside a bubble. You put on a TV show, or you're all the time on this foolish correspondence on your phone. This is your entire life. That's it. Previously, it wasn't so. And we don't live with animals. What animals do I have? I have a cat or a dog at home. Really, if someone experiences some kind of death, it's of his dog or something. Dr. Lightman, yeah, I heard this from several people, that I can't go on vacation because my dog's old and what will I do with him? Yeah, but how does that affect our perception of death? Does it push us away from it, or internally wise? Dr. Lightman, it gives us a greater ability to more quickly go through this stage that we'll see how disconnected we are from the real life, and that we're like in a spaceship. This is how Earth is built, that we're like in a spaceship. And so what follows is that later we'll have to discover this in a very bitter feeling. Yael, and this advances us toward what? Dr. Lightman, for us to give account, but not about this death, but about that we're already dead. Yael, can you explain this? Dr. Lightman, that right now we're dead. That we made some kind of artificial life for ourselves, inflating ourselves with different things, playing around with different things, but where's our real life? That we have to make something out of our life. Life, was given to us by nature for something else, and we play like little children, and mom's calling, come on, you have to stop playing, and we don't want to. So, to feel that we're experiencing death, to wake up from that, this is actually our goal. Dr. Lightman, thank you very much. I see that there are many more questions left. Dr. Lightman, true. In the meantime, thank you very much. Thank you, Yael. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.
How long will the Creator test me? Question: will the Creator continue to play with me and test me until the end of my life? Answer: until the end of this life and also in the next lives, until you fully reveal that He is the only one who exists. Question: how long should I wait for this? Answer: until you determine in all the parts of your soul, in every cell of your soul, that everything stems from the Creator and that He is the only one who manages creation. This is how the whole correction of the soul is expressed. Question: if I manage to reach the Creator's level, will I see that all the other people are good? Answer: not yet. You will feel that only in a state of absolute correction when not only you, but also all the others, which you feel as existing outside of yourself, attain the Creator, as there is none else besides Him. From CAB TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, November 24, 2019. The growth of egoism determines evolution. Question: what is the reason that people have lost touch with each other, are afraid to unite into families, and can't find a partner? Answer: egoism. There is no other force that counteracts all our supposedly good intentions and impulses. It is only our ego that makes us want more than others, in spite of others, against others. We can't do anything about it. Fighting it is useless. Therefore, we need to know how to receive the upper force to balance the ego. This is the method of rising above egoism, which allows you to use it for the benefit of yourself and others in order to reach the level of the Creator. Our entire evolution is the growth of egoism in us. For thousands of years, every day, egoism in humanity has been increasing more and more. The science of Kabbalah explains how we can apply it correctly. In this we are helped by the innermost, most powerful upper force that controls everything and teaches us how to see, evaluate, connect with everything, and use the egoistic power correctly. By acting this way, we basically change our fate. Question: our egoism, in fact, grows with evolution? Answer: of course. It is the growth of egoism that determines evolution. Question: where does this lead us? Answer: either to destruction or to the correct use of egoism. Question: how can we make sure that this does not lead to our destruction? Answer: everything is already laid down in the program of nature. In the end, we will not die and will not disappear. At the last minute, our egoism will turn into the opposite of itself. It will see, feel, but this is at the very last stage, that if it does not take this step, it will perish. This will egotistically lead it to the opposite action, to a contradiction with itself. From CAB TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, May 24, 2020.